Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's episode of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices mostly somewhere in the United States.
And this is Dr. Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And its vicinities. And on this episode, we're going to be talking about July's critical decision in emergency medicine issue. And if you don't know what critical decisions is, what are you waiting for? It is ACEP's official CME publication. Each month, we discuss two lessons, either bread and butter emergency medicine or things that are cutting edge.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, the critical ECG, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
So let's start off with our first lesson of the day. Watch your back. Back pain as a red flag symptom. Thank you to Drs. Nikki Kelly and Michael Bond for writing this issue.
And we have a fantastic surprise for this lesson. We actually have Dr. Nikki Kelly with us to talk about the article.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about some red flags and back pain today.
So Nikki, what got you interested in writing about this topic?
I think back pain is just a really common complaint that we see in the emergency department, and it's actually usually routed to lower acuity areas in the department, so fast track areas, and it can just be very misleading since back pain really can have disaster diagnoses that appear in disguise. I think it's really important that we don't let an ESI or a patient location dissuade us from pursuing a clinically indicated workup in our patients with back pain.
Definitely. So what are some red flags we need to watch out for in a patient's history and exam when they're coming in with back pain?
Some of the more classically taught risk factors are extremes of age, a history of trauma, a history of cancer, unexplained weight loss, pain that is worse at night, fevers, and bowel and bladder incontinence. Cancers that are also most concerning because of their metastatic properties would be breast, lung, prostate, renal, gastrointestinal, or even thyroid cancer. As for trauma, I think it's really important to consider the mechanism because a ground level fall in an older adult versus in a healthy 30-year-old individual will have a lot different impact for those patients. It's important to keep in mind that these red flags are there to supplement our clinical judgment and not just replace it.
That's a great point. What about the physical exam?
I can't emphasize this enough, but we really, really, really need to walk our patients. Physical exam should include an assessment of patient's gait, their strength, their sensation, as well as deep tendon reflexes. I think it's also important to examine a patient's functional strength, as well as their perceived weakness when they're in a seated position. I like to think of functional strength almost as my mini physical therapy evaluation. So that's documenting the patient's ability to squat, stand on their toes, rock back on their heels, as well as their mobility in their back exam. So their ability to flex anteriorly, posteriorly, and even laterally. If a patient can do this, but they perceive weakness when they are seated, it's more likely that their weakness is due to their pain.
Such a fantastic examination, Pearl. So let's talk about spinal epidural aphthesis. Some of the cases are quite obvious, a documented fever and back pain in a patient who currently uses IV drugs. However, there are other tricky presentations, and those are the ones that get us. What are your thoughts on approaching those patients with tricky presentations when you're thinking of spinal epidural aphthesis?
First, I think it's really important that we need to recognize there are many risk factors other than just IV drug use. Diabetes, long-term steroid use, spine abnormalities from trauma or surgery, epidural anesthesia, and even recent bacterial infections are just some of the risk factors. And there's even a more comprehensive table in the article. The classic presentation of fever, back pain, and neurologic manifestations are only seen in 10% of cases. Therefore, patients who have risk factors and back pain may need an infectious workup. However, if their white blood cells, their ESR, and their CRP are all within normal limits, and the patient doesn't have any neurodeficits, the risk of spinal epidural abscess is really, really low, and no further workup is necessarily indicated.
Got it. Now let's talk about another tricky diagnosis called Aquinas syndrome. What signs and symptoms can help us identify this?
Cotta Aquina syndrome is such a tricky diagnosis, and I'm so sorry to say that just no sign or symptom combination can reliably diagnose or exclude it. The classic features include bilateral radiculopathy, perineal numbness, which we usually think of as saddle anesthesia, altered bladder function, loss of rectal tone, as well as sexual dysfunction. However, the data tells a different story. In one study, saddle anesthesia was actually the only clinical feature associated with Cotta Aquina syndrome on MRI, and loss of bladder control is not actually predictive of the diagnosis. I suggest that obtaining a post-void residual may be helpful, and it should really strongly be considered in our patients who are considering this diagnosis.
All right. So let's keep talking about deadly stuff, but let's step a little bit outside the spine itself. Let's talk about triple A's.
So the classic presentation for a triple A is hypotension, back or flank pain, and a pulsatile mass, which are highly concerning for a ruptured triple A. And of course, like all classic presentations, it's pretty uncommon. I think of renal colic in older individuals who have never had kidney stones, that it should also be suspicious for an acute aortic pathology. Sometimes the diagnosis is actually incidentally made on a spine x-ray that shows the aneurysm and calcifications itself. In any elderly patient with renal colic and no history of kidney stones, I'm going to grab my ultrasound and look at their aorta bedside.
Absolutely. That's a good point too. Now, in terms of imaging, I guess, in general, what any pearls about imaging for back pain?
So x-rays are really commonly ordered in patients with back pain, and they're actually not always indicated. In patients with red flags who require imaging, the x-ray may be considered as the first step. However, their sensitivity is lower in patients with osteoporosis, such as older adults. Patients with low back pain who have not improved within 6 weeks of conservative therapy may actually then require the imaging.
Any pearls regarding obtaining advanced imaging?
If you're suspecting infection, malignancy, or postoperative sequela, then MRI with gadolinium is the appropriate test. When you are suspecting spinal epidural abscess, a whole spine, so that includes cervical, thoracic, and lumbar, imaging will be needed. When thinking of trauma, non-contrast CT is obtained to rule out fractures, and if the patient has a neurodeficit as well, MRI should be obtained as well, as CT has limited evaluation of epidural hematomas.
Got it. Now, what if the patient can't tolerate an MRI or your institution does not even have one?
Although not commonly used, the CT with myelogram is also an alternative option to the MRI. We can also consider bedside ultrasound for non-spinal pathologies such as triple A, but if your institution doesn't have MRI, and that is the test that's required for the diagnosis, you should consider transferring that patient for a higher level of care.
All right, so let's completely switch gears from the scary causes of back pain to the bread and butter musculoskeletal back pain that we see and have all the time. Any management pearls there?
I can't emphasize this enough, but NSAIDs, they have the best efficacy and should be the first line treatment for back pain. We should also consider regularly scheduling it for the first few days so that patients know when to take their NSAIDs at home. Adding acetaminophen for non-fractures has proven to have a little benefit. In terms of muscle relaxants such as cyclobenzaprine, they may be used for acute presentation, and that's talking less than 2 weeks in patients with muscle spasms or moderate to severe pain. However, we have to be careful of the side effects in older adults. Lidocaine patches can also be helpful in patients with paraspinal pain, but I can't emphasize this enough that opiates should be used in limitation. Steroids as well, whether one parenteral dose or short course, have actually no proven benefit in acute, radicular, or non-radicular pain.
Absolutely. Can't agree with this more. So you got the patient's pain under control. You've ruled out some of these scary things. We're near the end of their visit and we want to discharge a patient. Any pearls regarding that?
Similar to what we do with all of our patients in the emergency department, I think it's really important that we review the imaging and the report ourselves, as we may find things that were missed. Also, return visits to the emergency department should be viewed with extra caution, as it may be an opportunity to catch a misdiagnosis. Patients with abnormal, non-emergent findings should also be provided with clear follow-up instructions as well as return precautions. It's really important that we reassess our patients before discharging them, and that includes repeating their vital signs as well as seeing them walk. They may need mobility aids or a physical therapy assessment prior to discharge if you have any concern about their safety.
Well, thank you so much for such a great article and an engaging review. Any take-homes that you want to leave our listeners with?
There's a couple pearls that I think are really important for our listeners to take home. One of them is that the majority of back pain complaints are actually benign musculoskeletal etiologies, and for that reason, there's really no good screening test for a lot of the more serious pathology. It's important that we use red flags as a supplement rather than replacing our decisions about whether advanced imaging and lab tests are needed in working up patients with back pain. I also think it's important to remember that NSAIDs are our first-line therapy in patients with acute low back pain. If there is concern for more serious pathology, such as spinal epidural abscess, then a whole spine MRI with gadolinium should be obtained because skip lesions are common and they can be missed if we only image part of the spine. Again, severe spinal pathology can be missed on the initial emergency department visit, so please pay special attention to any bounce back emergency department visits within a short period of time. And then just to bring it all home, I think that it's important to know that back pain in the absence of red flags typically doesn't warrant imaging or laboratory tests. And it may be hard for the emergency department physician to be patient, but unless that pain is persisting beyond 6 weeks, then conservative measures are okay.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nikki.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you guys for having me. This was fun.
And keeping up with potentially scary infections. For our clinical pediatrics this month, we're talking about peritonsillar abscesses and deep space neck infections.
This case is about a really common scenario, a child with a sore throat, and they had a typical presentation with a positive throat culture for strep, but the case ends up taking quite a different turn.
Yep, and a scary one at it. Tonsillitis was complicated by cellulitis, then purulence and necrotic material between the pharyngeal wall and tonsillar capsule. And then it extended into the dangerous space. I'm talking about a peritonsillar abscess. And the dangerous space is technically called an alar space, and it creates a direct connection between the neck and the mediastinum, which allows extension of the infection right into the mediastinum. Not so fun. Another important complication to think about is Lemierre syndrome, which is also known as post-anginal sepsis, in which the infection extends to the tonsillar and internal jugular vein and causing IJ thrombosis with possible septic emboli within the lungs and pleural effusion.
Woo. So it's not just about airway compromise that we have to worry about. Lots of other things too. How and when are we supposed to diagnose these complications?
So when patients come in with trismus, decreased range of motion of neck, inability to tolerate oral secretions, a muffled hot potato voice, we need to think of this. If a person is having pain with posterior extension of the neck, that's most likely consistent with a retropharyngeal abscess. CT is our gold standard for diagnosis, and we can actually use a low voltage scan for lower radiation in kids. We can also use ultrasound, but that's just going to show us peritonsillar abscesses, not deeper infections. MRI is, of course, fantastic, but an absolute logistical nightmare, especially when we're concerned about the airway, which we always should be, or the patient requires sedation, which if they're small, they would.
Very true. Now, how do we treat these patients?
We start with the ABCs as always. Intubation would need a dibble setup and having ENT or anesthesia at the bedside if possible. Consider fiber optic or wake intubation due to the amount of edema and to keep those airway reflexes there. Keep in mind that intubating a patient may actually cause rupture of the abscess and pus in the airway, so you need to prepare for that. When you're covering them with antibiotics, you should cover them for staph and strep. And if you're concerned about Lemierre, avoid macrolides because they tend to have fusiform and those are resistant to macrolides. Ill-appearing patients would need a broad-spectrum antibiotic like piperacillin tazobactam, clindamycin, ampicillin sulbactam, and most abscesses will need to be drained.
Wow, this is a great quick review. Definitely check it out.
And moving on to other scary infections, our critical image of the month is right lower quadrant pain in pregnancy. So what imaging modality are we supposed to use to evaluate for appendicitis in pregnancy? Because that can be quite tricky. The American College of Radiology rates non-contrast MRI as usually appropriate, ultrasound is usually indicated, and CT as maybe appropriate. And it's important to note that MRI is without gadolinium because both the ACR and ACOG recommend against GAD in pregnancy unless it is absolutely necessary. So the required information cannot be obtained otherwise. It will affect the care of the patient or the fetus, or it cannot be deferred. There are no actual known teratogenic effects for the gadolinium, but it's just simply not enough data.
Yeah, it's a hard decision to make for sure. We know that MRI for appendicitis in pregnancy certainly has good sensitivity and specificity in the 90s, but ultrasound, while, you know, it's an ideal modality since it doesn't have radiation, the sensitivity can be quite low if you don't obviously visualize the appendix. But if you were to, of course, see the appendix, then you would have, you know, high specificity for ruling out appendicitis. Now, if you really have to, of course, you can always still consider getting a CT abdomen pelvic as, you know, just a single CAT scan's radiation dose is technically below teratogenic exposure level. So it really, of course, depends on, you know, the patient in front of you and what you're working with.
Definitely a great review of what we're supposed to do in a very tricky situation. So moving on to a completely different topic. The LSA review this month is about cerebral intraparenchymal hemorrhage, and we're reviewing an article by Gross et al. That was published in 2019 in JAMA that was entitled Cerebral Intraparenchymal Hemorrhage, a Review.
It's a good review and talks about that, you know, 20% of strokes are intraparenchymal hemorrhages, and the majority of it comes from hypertension or cerebral amyloid angiopathy. Don't forget that intraparenchymal hemorrhages can also occur from other causes, such as hemorrhagic conversion of stroke, coagulopathies, vascular malformations, tumors, etc. We're quite familiar with how these patients present. They often have acute onset headaches, nausea, vomiting, maybe even seizure, and certainly focal deficits. They can also present with severe hypertension or even a depressed mental status. So, of course, you know, you really have to address the initial ABCs. One thing that I always like to remind people is that a lot of these patients can deteriorate during their early in their hospital course, whether it's during transport to the ED or even in the emergency department. That's just part of the natural history of these hemorrhages. And when we're making a diagnosis, of course, we get a non-contrast head CT for the finding of the intraparenchymal hemorrhage, but if you were to get a CT angiogram or a CT venogram, those can also be helpful to identify etiologies or predictors of hematoma expansion. This section has a really good table that outlines essentially the steps in managing these patients, as well as some great clinical pearls. I think it all narrows down to focusing on controlling the hypertension, good blood pressure control, getting hemostasis or reverse the coagulopathy, and if there's any concerns about mass effect and intracranial hypertension, treating that. In general, we're targeting a systolic blood pressure less than 140, but of course, some of these patients can present extremely hypertensive, and so, you know, you may have to stepwise bring that down to a lower goal. If you're dealing with a coagulopathy of some sort, prothrombin complex concentrates are usually better than FFP, especially if you're dealing with vitamin K antagonists or direct thrombin inhibitors. Remember that platelet transfusions are not recommended. We talked about this quite a while back. And some of these patients may even need, of course, neurosurgical intervention, whether with a ventriculostomy, surgical evacuation, etc. So it's worthwhile seeing if they can be admitted to a stroke or a neurosurgical center.
A great review of a great review article. And I'm sure you are ecstatic, Wendy, because your LLSA review this time was about neurotopics.
Yay!
So moving on to something completely different again. Critical EKG of this month shows the signs of hypothermia. And we can see like sinus bradycardia, AFib with slow ventricular response, prolongation of intervals, Osborne waves, and the fun one, which is the shivering artifact on the EKG in hypothermia. The Osborne waves, which tend to show up on a lot of exams, but on actual EKG tend to be most prominent in the precordial leads, they get smaller and disappear as the patient is rewarmed.
Maybe your patient who was found hypothermic also has what are critical cases in orthopedics and trauma this month, which is talking about.
So wait. So the patient had a critical orthopedic and trauma problem. So they fell in the ice and like in the snow.
Exactly.
They turned into an icicle.
Yeah.
So what did they have? Right. What are we talking about in critical cases in orthopedics and trauma this month?
A patella fracture with traumatic arthrotomy.
It seems like patella fractures are showing up quite a lot on critical decisions, huh? Well, yeah, patella problems.
It's an important thing to review. That's true. Patella problems. Yeah. They're not that common, only less than 1% of all fractures, but you can, you know, see them after MVCs or other direct trauma to a flexed knee. And these patients certainly would complain of knee pain. You may find that there's a palpable defect. But it's important to evaluate whether their extensor mechanism is intact. On x-ray, you may even find a high or a low riding patella suggesting injury to the patella or the quadricep tendon.
If you see a patient with your patellar fracture, knee immobilizer, crutches, and ask them to be non-weight bearing until they can follow up. However, if they have a disrupted extensor mechanism, they most likely will need surgery, but that can be done as an outpatient, so that's not a reason to keep them in the hospital. Now, if they have traumatic arthrotomy, they're going to need antibiotics, tetanus update if needed, and emergent washout. And if you're not sure if the trauma caused that arthrotomy or went into the synovial space, then you can evaluate that with a saline load test or get a CT.
Now we're going to shift gears quite a bit to our critical procedure this month, which is on reduction of a rectal prolapse. We may see this, you know, more commonly in pediatric and elderly patients, and we do want to treat it promptly because it can prevent further, you know, damage to the tissue and the sphincter and may even avoid operative care for these patients. If the tissue is really edematous, you can apply granulated sugar or gauze soaked in sugar water for 10 to 20 minutes. Just make sure that you're not using a sugar substitute.
So no Splenda on the rectum.
That's right.
Got it. And while you're looking for real sugar in the emergency department, and maybe actually a little easier to just find an anxiolytic or a sedative to help with the process. After reduction, you can apply pressure dressing to prevent short-term recurrence. And it's extremely important to not forget about follow-up evaluation for possible malignancy as a cause, especially near older adults. And keeping up with the same anatomical location, our second lesson of this issue is bringing up the rear, perirectal, perianal, and palatinal abscesses. Thank you to Drs. Matthew Sherman, Dalbir Baga, and Vietvong Vo for writing this article.
Okay, so first things first, what is the difference between perirectal, perianal, and palatinal abscesses?
So anorectal abscesses, which include perianal and perirectal abscesses, usually originate from a blocked anal crypt gland. These glands are present at the dentate line. And the perianal abscesses are usually superficial, whereas perirectal abscesses extend into a deeper space. And they can include ischiorectal, intersphincteric, or supralevator spaces. The ischiorectal, which is also called ischioanal, can be seen as a diffuse tenderness and induration within the buttocks. Intersphincteric may have no external signs because, as you would imagine, they're a little deeper, and the patients would only have tenderness on the digital rectal exam. Supralevator abscesses are really deep with no superficial signs whatsoever or may not be palpated on digital rectal exam because they may be that deep. Patients present with pain during defecation, urinary retention, neural symptoms from like local compression, or with symptoms of a systemic infection and like sepsis, and that would be the focus of infection. They can also arise from like an intra-abdominal source rather than coming in from that blocked anal crypt gland situation, such as a perforated colon or from like inflammatory bowel disease. Thankfully, this tricky one forms only less than 5% of the total abscesses in that area. If you're having a rough time kind of like visualizing where these kind of pieces fit in, the article has a great figure that explains where these locations of these different abscesses are. Palatinal abscesses are a whole other beast. And a whole other conversation.
I see. Yes, I agree. That figure is super helpful to visualize all this. So what are the risk factors then for developing these?
So men are twice as likely to have these abscesses at least.
than women and have their complications. Things like Crohn's disease, radiation fibrosis, diabetes, chronic steroid use, or any reason to have an immunocompromised state, malignancy, trauma, those all make people more likely to have anorectal abscesses in general.
Okay. Any pearls for the diagnoses of anorectal abscesses?
We should maintain a high index of suspicion in patients coming in with anorectal pain, even if there are no superficial signs on physical examination, because that might not be present depending on the location of the abscess. Not all rectal pain with defecation and an external normal exam is an anal fissure. Sometimes it's something that's a lot more serious.
Very true, very true. What's the treatment then?
So all of these abscesses must be IND'd as soon as possible. If it's superficial, whether it's like a perianal or a scurectal one, it may be done at the bedside, obviously with the correct technique and adequate anesthesia. If it's a deeper abscess or if you suspect that there's a fistula, these patients need to go to the OR. Unlike our current practice with other skin and soft tissue infections, you should give all of these patients antibiotics to decrease the risk of fistulization. And in addition to that, sitz bath and wound checks are important. Packing does not appear to be necessary, and you need to be very wary of the fact that fistulas may be present in up to 70% of patients. So they need close surgical follow-up because they may need a fistulotomy later on.
Got it. Okay, then now let's shift gears a little bit to pilonidal abscesses.
So pilonidal abscesses are caused by the development of a pilonidal sinus with subsequent blockage that is followed by a purulent infection. And they're treated in a similar manner to cutaneous abscesses. Now, when you continue to have repeated infections and ingrown hairs, then eventually that issue worsens. And there are many theories on why they happen in the first place. It seems to be that they're more of an acquired condition rather than a congenital condition, but the jury is still out on that.
Interesting. How do these patients present with their symptoms?
So patients present with pain and swelling overlying the sacrum and coccyx and the upper portion of the gluteal cleft, quite distant from the anus itself. Palpable induration is more common than actual fluctuance. And classically, patients present with overlying erythema as well. Patients have their initial presentation in their late teens, early 20s, and recurrence is quite common, up to 50% of patients.
How do we treat these then?
Well, the first question we got to ask ourselves, is it infected? If it's just a cyst, because that's what happens eventually, there's no need to start antibiotics, there's no need to drain it, just leave it alone. If the patient has cellulitis with no abscess, then just give them antibiotics. Now, if they have an abscess, then you need to do an IND with local anesthesia and all the good stuff. Needle aspiration may be considered, but there's no like clear studies on that one way or the other. For this, we don't know if packing is necessary. Many of the studies that discourage packing and talk about the fact that we don't need to pack abscesses anymore seem to exclude patients with pilonidal abscesses. So maybe those are people you still want to pack. And that's actually part of common practice. People commonly pack pilonidal abscesses for like 24 to 48 hours and apply a bulky dressing on top. And last but not least, if there's not a lot of cellulitis, then do not give them antibiotics. An important pearl is to make sure to differentiate it from a large perirectal abscess that's tracking all the way superiorly. So you need to do a thorough local exam. Because of course, if it's a perirectal abscess, then that's a whole other beast. And remember that when patients are coming in with recurrent pilonidal abscesses, they may actually have fistula tract, and definitive care requires surgical removal of this tract so they don't keep having these recurrences.
That makes sense. Thank you, Donna. This was a great review. Any final take-homes for our listeners?
I think my biggest take-home point is that this is the last chapter in the surgical book that probably everybody ignored during their surgery rotation, but it is quite important. It is literally a pain in the rear. So we need to take care of these patients because these infections can get complicated and their management is slightly different than our typical abscesses.
Absolutely. That makes sense. Now moving on to our drug box this month. It is on Giapreza, which is an angiotensin II infusion that it can be used in septic or distributive shock that was studied in Athos III clinical trial. Which, you know, as you can imagine, angiotensin can improve blood pressure in shock. But the study also found that there was higher incidence of arterial and venous thrombotic and thromboembolic events. Some other adverse drug reactions included thrombocytopenia, tachycardia, delirium, acidosis, peripheral ischemia. If you are using this medication, be cautious if the patient is on an ACE inhibitor, since that can increase their response. Whereas if the patient is on an angiotensin receptor blocker, ARB, then of course that would reduce the response.
Totally makes sense. However, it does not make me want to reach for it when a person is having septic shock just yet. And moving on, and moving on to other things I would not want to reach out to is lots of methotrexate, because that is our tox box this month, which is acute oral methotrexate overdose. Now, methotrexate is used in cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, and it is the most commonly used oral antineoplastic agent overdose. Now, the concerns are that with massive overdoses or repeated overdoses, or if a person has renal failure, then they're not going to excrete as much and end up with a buildup of methotrexate. Simple things are like GI distress, stomatitis, hepatitis. Now, the problem is that they can have bone marrow suppression as well, which can be delayed up to 1 week. So, obtain that CBC, that CMP, the methotrexate level, and if you catch them early on, then give charcoal, and if you have renal failure, it may be worth giving multiple doses of charcoal. The one thing that you could do to perhaps enhance the elimination is to give the people bicarb. One other thing that you could do is if a patient has renal failure or if the dose that they ingest is more than 1,000 milligrams, consider giving them leucovorin. And if a patient got a very large intrathecal or intravenous overdose, then glucuropidase is something that you can use. So maybe you should spell that and write it down so that you can look it up in your computer ordering system next time this happens. Hemodialysis is questionable unless the person is having a renal injury from the overdose. And if they're asymptomatic 6 hours post-ingestion, then they can go home.
Not a very benign drug at all.
Nope. So beware the methotrexate. Well, thank you, Wendy, for taking the time to go through this lesson with me. I learned a lot. Our dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this podcast.
We hope that you find the Critical Decisions publication and our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
Follow us on Twitter and share your thoughts and cases with us. My Twitter handle is at Dania Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.